So if you are at a point in your life where you do think, I need something different, like I know something's off, I don't know what to do, I need a fresh start, I'm telling you, you will not be disappointed by trying out Celebrate Recovery Friday nights, 7 o'clock. I want to show you a picture, and I want you to try to guess what my topic is going to be today. Your clue here is cheesy wordplay. So show this picture, and then you guess what you think I'm going to talk about. Anybody? You can say it out loud if you got it. Willpower! You know, it is what it is. Willpower, it's a good thing. Willpower is what enables you to accomplish your goals. Willpower enables you to do hard things, even when it's really, really difficult to keep going. So willpower is what enables you to write a lot of thank you cards after a birthday party or a shower when you don't want to write those thank you cards. Willpower is the thing you need when you're trying to study really late for a test the next day and you have to power through. You need willpower. Willpower is what enables you to eat a carrot instead of carrot cake. Willpower. It's very, very important. Now, show this next picture here and try to guess go to the next. Is there one more picture of Will? Yeah, this one. Okay, what do you think the point here is of this second Will picture? Willpower has limitations. So it's not always going to work for you every time. In fact, this picture of this boy and the marshmallows, this one of the most famous psychological experiments of all time is back in the 60s, and these psychologists got a bunch of four-year-olds, and they put a marshmallow in front of them, and they said, hey, you can eat this marshmallow right now, or you can wait 5 minutes, and you get two marshmallows. And now, many of the kids were like, 5 minutes, whatever, give me the mallow, and they ate it. But a certain group of kids said, no, I'm going to wait. I'm going to practice self-control. I'm going to use my willpower. And they waited the 5 minutes, and they got their two marshmallows. Well, these researchers followed these kids for decade after decade, and it turns out the kids that waited the few minutes for the second marshmallow, they ended up graduating college with a higher degree of success. They stayed out of prison more. They earned more money. They were less likely to be overweight. And so they developed this theory that people who practice their willpower actually end up, in some ways, being more successful people. However, there's other studies that show this is not always the case. Like, willpower, just like this picture shows, it does have limitations. So, for example, I read another study where this researcher brought all these people in, and he had them rank their own perception of their willpower first. Like, how good are you at self-control? And how much do you think you can resist X, Y, and Z? And they all filled out these forms. And then they went through a series of tests. And the tests were about eating cookies, procrastinating, and for former smokers, it was, can you keep from lighting up that cigarette? And what the researcher discovered was that he actually coined this term called restraint bias. In this study, most people failed. And what he discovered is that we have a tendency to overestimate our ability to use our self-control and to use our willpower. We think we can do it. Oh, yeah, yeah. I won't eat this dessert. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll lose this weight. Oh, yeah, yeah. I won't buy this. Oh. We think we're going to be good. But time after time, we fail. And so the reality is that willpower is good. It's powerful, but it's not ultimate. Like, if you only rely on your willpower, it's not going to work out. There are many times where willpower helps you, but there are also times where willpower is simply going to fail you. In fact, I want to read this passage from Paul. This is one of the most relatable lines in the entire Bible. It's Romans 7. Paul says, I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. In other words, he's saying, I have the will, like I want to do what's good, but having the will is not quite enough to fulfill the will. Verse 21, he says, I find this law at work. Although I want to do good, evil is right there with me. So the reason that willpower will never be your ultimate power is because willpower has a roommate. And the roommate has a name, sin. Now today, it's pretty popular to deny or at least rename the very existence of sin. But when we do this, I think we're actually crippling our ability to transform into the image of Jesus when we deny the reality of sin. So I'll use myself as an example. When I really do some introspection, I can sense part of me, the preacher, that wants power, that wants fame, that wants fortune. There's a part of me that always wants to be right. There's a part of me that can be and sometimes wants to be mean. There's a part of me that wants to avoid sacrifice, humility, turning the other cheek. There's even a part of me that wants you to think I am better than I actually am. Now, does this part of me always win the day? No, many times it doesn't, but I am acknowledging it's there. Like, that's in me. And my guess is if you did some introspection, you would also say those kinds of things are in you. And the big question is, what do we call that? Like, what is that? Well, there's a lot of people today, a lot of ideology today, which would say, okay, Phil, you got to relax. Don't be too hard on yourself. That's not really greed. That's just ambition, like a good ambition. And Phil, that's not really lust. That's just desire, like the good kind of desire. And that's not really oppression you're feeling towards others. That's just opportunity to be successful. Phil, this is just your animal brain at play. Nothing wrong. This is who you were meant to be. So don't worry about these things. You just be true to who you are. Many people today would say that about you. They would say that about me. In other words, in my perception, I think being authentic has replaced being righteous as the most attractive attribute of our culture. So authenticity, let's think about this for a minute. Authenticity is a really good thing. Like, you want to be genuine. You want to be real. You don't like being around fake people. I don't like being around fake people. I don't like being a fake person myself. I want to be authentic. Like, there's a lot of good things about authenticity. The dark side of authenticity and being genuine is it's really easy to rationalize and justify immorality under the guise of authenticity. So part of transforming into the image of Jesus is to recognize, okay, there really is something in me that's not right. There's a battle within. This is how actually Paul frames it in the same chapter, Romans 7. So verse 22, he says, in my inner being, I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in me, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within me. What a wretched man that I am. So Paul's acknowledging, like, and this is Paul. Like, the guy writes half the New Testament. He's the primary missionary that starts the movement. All these church plants around the ancient world at that time are driven by Paul. And he's saying, I'm a wretched man. Like, he's acknowledging something that's very, very important, that if you want to transform, you got to deal with this sin inside. A house divided against itself cannot stand, and a heart divided against itself cannot grow. And so Paul's acknowledging this. So maybe you can relate to this line from author Leslie Jamison. She wrote this book called The Recovering. It was a best-selling book. And she said, I needed to believe that in something stronger than my willpower. The willpower was a fine-tuned machine, fierce and humming, and had done plenty of things. It got me straight A's, got me my papers written, got me through cross-country training runs. But when I applied it to drinking, the only thing I felt was that I was turning my life into a small, joyless, clenched fist. So it works on one level, willpower. But Leslie is saying there are certain things in life where it doesn't work. And the Apostle Paul in Romans 7 is saying there are certain things in life where even the best Christian in the world, it doesn't work. Willpower has limitations. And so we're actually all left in this somewhat of a conundrum here, which is it's the question of what do you do when your willpower fails? Like, what do you do when you've tried for weeks or months or years to overcome something or become the kind of person that you want to become or to restore a relationship or to kick a habit, and it doesn't work? Like, what do you do? What do I do? Here's the next line in Romans 7, really important line. Romans 7, 24. Paul says, "Who will rescue me from this body that is subject to death? Thanks be to God, who delivers me through Jesus Christ our Lord." So notice that first word, who. So when Paul comes to this conclusion that I'm a wretched man and I've got this battle between evil and good going on in my heart, when he works towards what he's going to do about that, he doesn't start with the word, what is going to save me? In other words, he's not saying, here's three steps which solve my sin problem. And he's not saying, well, if I just have this correct medication or if I just go to therapy, that's going to solve the sin problem. He's right when he says, who will rescue me? Because Paul understands that the only thing that solves what's going on inside himself is somebody outside himself. Like, it cannot originate from within. In fact, this sets up, like, Paul's statements here set up one of the most remarkable chapters in the Bible, which is Romans chapter 8. And so what Paul is doing at the end of Romans 7 is really important. He's doing what I would call the renunciation of self-preservation. Like, on one level, maybe he thinks at a former time of his life that self-preservation is the way to go. Just work hard, do your best, and it's all going to work out. But he's coming to the point at the end of Romans 7 where he's saying it's not working. So there's a renunciation of self-preservation, and then that leads to one of the most remarkable chapters in the entire Bible, Romans 8, which is all about the unimaginable, overpowering love of God. Now, there's a verse in the middle of Romans 8 that's really, really important. The end of Romans 8 is very famous. The beginning's famous. Here's a verse from the middle of Romans 8 where Paul says, "If the Spirit of Jesus, or if the Spirit of Him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, then He who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of His Spirit who lives in you." This is such a key truth here where Paul is trying to get through to the readers of Romans, and I think through the Spirit he's trying to get through to us today. It's the idea that the power that brought Jesus out of the grave wasn't only reserved for Easter Sunday. There is a way through the Spirit that believers can access this transcendent power of God. And that does not start within you. It comes from outside of you. Now, some of you are like, well, duh, I get that, Phil, and I believe in this, and I've seen this in my life. Like, I have noticed that there are certain kinds of people that their faith is so strong, it's because they've experienced what Paul is saying here. Like, they can say, this is what my life was, Phil, but now this is what my life is, and so therefore, I don't need a bunch of apologetics books. Like, I know in the deepest part of my soul that there's a God because I've experienced the power of the resurrected Christ in my heart. Like, there are people I know, some of you sitting in the pews, like, you know this deeply. There are others of us, and we don't know it. Like, we can read it. Okay, yeah, he's saying that the power of the resurrected Jesus is at living in my heart. We can, like, think about it intellectually, but it's not an embodied practice in our life. Like, we don't experience it. And I want to give you my opinion as to why many, many, many Christians don't experience this power of God. I think it's because we have unknowingly worshiped individualism. Like, it's the air we breathe. I've referenced this a few times in recent weeks, but I want to talk about it for just a minute. We are so much more affected by this than we think. Like this, here's the motto of individualism. Suck it up, get it done, don't depend on anyone. Like this is who we are as a people, as a nation. We are individualist. In fact, there's a really smart guy, Dr. Gert Hofstede, and in the 70s, he developed a way to analyze different cultures that is still accepted across disciplines today as the best way to do cultural analysis. And so he looked at the world and he had this big question, okay, how do we compare the culture of Argentina to the culture of Russia? And how do we even compare Canada to India? Like, how do we do this? And so he developed this theory where he has six categories where he analyzes culture. So you've got power distance, indulgent versus restraint, long-term versus short-term results, masculinity versus femininity, tolerance of uncertainty, and individuality. And he has all these metrics by which he studies all these countries. Well, I want to zone in here on individualism. So he developed all these materials which he would put in front of countries, and then he would give the country a score. And it was between collectivism and individualism. So collectivism is this philosophy where my very identity comes from a group. So I am not necessarily an individual, but I simply am part of the tribe, part of the family, part of the group. That's collectivism. Individualism is where your identity comes from yourself. I am me, this is the world, but I see everything through the filter of an individual human being. So the most collectivist country in the world is Guatemala. They scored a 6 on a scale of 0 to 100. So if you're closer to 0, you're collectivist. If you're closer to 100, you're individualist. The United States of America is the most individualistic country on planet Earth. We scored a 91. Now, that's not all necessarily bad. In fact, when it comes to being successful, making money, it's actually a really good trait. And you can trace that over the last several hundred years. Our country, because of individualism, has done a lot of good. And we've created a lot of industry, and our economy is amazing, and we have a lot of wealth. And we've used that wealth to do a lot of things. We've protected a lot of people with it. So it's really, really good if your goal is to make money. I would put forth, I don't know if it's the best if your goal is to grow faith. We swim in the waters of individualism, and then we wonder why we struggle with our faith. See, if you want to grow closer to God and deepen your faith, if you want to get unstuck from your pain, the pain of your present or the pain of your past, if you want to kick your bad attitude or your negativity, your destructive relationship or your addiction, here's the key idea today. Transformation is a work of God, not self. And so if you're trying to do this on your own, yeah, I'm just going to read one more book. I'm just going to have one more conversation with that expert. You can't do this. There is a limitation to you. So Paul writes this in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. He says, we are being transformed into his image. It's a passive verb there. God's doing the transformation. So in other words, like you could rearrange the furniture of your heart every week. Well, I'm going to get up 30 minutes early and do this, and I'm going to read this book, and I'm going to watch 30 less minutes of TV, and I'm going to eat this differently. That's just rearranging the furniture. But if you really want like the total remodel, where you become functionally a different human being who really does carry themselves with this immense amount of cruciformity of following the way of Christ and becoming benevolent and gentle and kind. And like if you really want to become that person, you can't do that. Like God has to do it. So going back to this book, Leslie, The Recovering, we left off the quote with this line, where she said, when I applied myself to drinking, the only thing I felt was that I was turning my life into a small, joyless, clenched fist. So that's her, like, willpower doesn't work. The next line, she says this. The higher power, which we would say God, that turned sobriety into more than deprivation was simply not me. That's all I knew. And so here we have this story from this lady who's just giving her testimony to the world, and she's saying, okay, it worked in a lot of things. Like when I wanted to make good grades, when I wanted to run cross country, yeah, I could use the willpower, but I couldn't beat my alcoholism. But the day I finally did, all I can tell you is that it wasn't me. Like something else helped me beat my alcoholism. It reminds me of the story in John chapter 9 where you got this blind man and the blind man's healed, and the Pharisees create this big debate as, well, how did this happen? And you know, how can we explain what went on? And they're trying to just, it's all a debate in the minds of the Pharisees. And the blind man, when he actually speaks up in the story in John 9, all he says is, well, I was blind and now I see. Like, that's all I know. I didn't do this. I can't see because I tried really hard. I can't see because I prayed all these prayers. I can't see because I went and saw this doctor. All I know is that I met this man named Jesus, and now I can see. Like, he believes that there is something outside himself that can change something inside himself. Another book I've been reading, which I've really enjoyed, and I hope in the coming months to share more content from this book with you, but I'll read one line from it. John Mark Comer, Live No Lies. He says, the disciplines, he's talking about spiritual disciplines right here, the disciplines are the means by which we access a power beyond us. They enable us to live from an animating energy and pneumatic force that is far more powerful than any inner resource we could possibly draw on. That line really captivated me because I make my living with words. I try to come up with words to communicate the ideas that I believe God is revealing to us in the Bible so that we can all understand them. But sometimes I struggle with how do I put into words this transcendent power from God. Well, I read this line and that it really just jumped off the page, this phrase, animating energy and pneumatic force. Like it's really not me. Like there really is something outside me. There really is something outside you that's working in the world. Like in other words, your faith is more than a mental mirage. This is not just a coping mechanism of the masses. Like there's a being out there, a compassionate, self-giving being that predates your birth. Like he's out there. And far too often we just try to struggle on our own without acknowledging like, whoa, there's something going on there. So I actually think of this as two moves. Move number one, we're actually good at. Move number one is have faith in God. Many of us have faith in God. You come to church, you're showing faith in God. You pray, you're showing faith in God. You sing, you're showing faith in God. We can make that move. The second move is harder. The second move is not faith in God, it's faith in the power of God. And that's a different move altogether. In fact, I want to read you a few passages here. One, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul is defending his ministry, and he says this. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power. And this is the key here at the end. So that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. Here's what I want to highlight. At the end of this verse, Paul does not say, so that your faith might rest in God. He says, so your faith can rest in the power of God. As in, there's a difference. Like, it's one thing to have faith in God. It's another thing to have faith in the power of God, in the animating force, the pneumatic energy that keeps the whole world in existence through his self-giving love. Faith in God is, I believe that God is. Faith in the power of God is, I believe that God does. And many, many people have faith in God, but do not have faith in the power of God. Another verse here, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 5, Paul says, our gospel came to you not simply with words, but also with power, with the Holy Spirit, and with deep conviction. So these people were not just there believing in God, they were believing that something was going to happen in the world now because of God. They believed in the power of God. 1 Corinthians 4:20, the kingdom of God is not a matter of talk, but of power. And then here's one of my favorites. It's tacked on at the very end of Colossians chapter 1. Paul's talking about his desire that everybody he preaches to grows into a mature follower of Jesus, and he delivers this amazing statement. He says, to this end, as in I want everybody to become a mature disciple, to this end I strenuously contend with all the energy Christ so powerfully works in me. That's an amazing verse. Because think about it, who's at work here? Is Paul working? Yes, Paul's working. He is laboring with all of his energy and all of his might. Like, he is working when he's writing these letters, when he's giving his sermons, when he's planting these churches, when he's doing his ministry. Like, he's working. Is God working? Yes. The energy which Paul is drawing on is from Christ himself. And so Paul recognizes that, yes, Paul can try really hard, but Paul knows that this is not just him. Like, there's something beyond him, truly beyond him, that is working in him and through him to change the world. Paul has faith in God. Paul also has faith in the power of God. And this is so important because when we get to this point in our life where we're like, yes, I have faith in God, but we refuse to believe in the power of God, we become Christian atheists. And a Christian atheist is someone who on Sundays says, Jesus, you're my king, and I'm going to sing all these songs, and I'll read the Bible, and yes, I believe in you, I believe in you, I believe in you. But then Monday through Saturday, they put their faith in their money, themselves, their medicine, and their government. That's a Christian atheist. And so if you don't want to be that kind of a person, then you have to make this move between having faith in God, yes, that's great, but have faith in the power of God. Like, you're not going to save the world. The government's not going to save the world. The medicine we have is amazing, but it's not going to save the world. Jesus is going to save the world, and his power is going to save the world. And so we have to have faith that the great solution to all of our trials and troubles and tribulations, it's going to come not from me, and it's not going to come from you. It's going to come from something outside of ourselves. So all I'm saying is I'm trying to bolster you and encourage you to believe not just in God, but in the power of God. And in fact, I want to share this story. It's so moving to me. A few months ago, we were all inspired on a Sunday morning when Sherry Duncan, wife of George Duncan, came forward in a wheelchair, wheeled by her son Todd, and she told us that the doctors had told her she was going to make it about 3 more months, and then she was going to pass away from cancer. And she wrote this note, and I read the note to you, and the note basically said, this is the news, but I'm at peace because I trust the Lord. And so it was this amazing moment. We prayed for her, but we were inspired by her. A few days ago, she invited Scott and I over to her house so she could share some thoughts about her memorial service. And so she was sitting in her recliner and very weak, and she told us a few songs she wanted sung. We had a little small talk, and then she said, I need to tell you what happened to me. And so we sat in silence, and she said, before I tell you what happened to me, you need to know I'm a very traditional woman, Church of Christ girl through and through, always behind the scenes, and what I'm about to tell you, most of my life I thought I would never say, and if anybody else said this, I would be really skeptical. But I have to tell you what happened. She said, I had a divine encounter with God. A few weeks ago, I'm sleeping, it's the middle of the night, and I wake up, and I feel God's presence more palpably than I've ever felt it in my entire life. I feel as if Jesus himself is right next to me, as real as a person in the room. And I felt so much peace in that moment, I cannot even put it into words. It was indescribable. And I said, well, why do you think this happened to you? And she said, I think it was simply God saying, I'm holding on to you. Everything's going to be okay. Well, a few days later, as she tells the story, her sister, who's named Joy, also seriously battling health. Well, her sister was in the hospital and went unresponsive. And so one of Sherry's family members said, hey, Sherry, do you want to go visit Joy? Well, Sherry was homebound and she hadn't been getting out. So Sherry thought about it. She said, yeah, I think I need to see Joy. I think I need to tell her something. So Sherry gets in the car and someone's driving her over to meet her sister. Well, Sherry has no idea, but that morning, Joy, who's unresponsive, starts saying Sherry's name over and over. Sherry, Sherry, Sherry. So you have the woman who's unresponsive saying the name of the sister who had the divine encounter from God, and neither of them know about the other's experience. And so Sherry gets into the hospital room, and she grabs Joy's hand, and she says, Joy, I'm here. And I know you can't talk, but I need you to know something that happened to me. Sherry tells Joy about the experience of Jesus visiting her. And then Sherry tells Joy, I'm going to hold your hand. We're together now, and we're going to be together really, really soon. Just hold on. Just a few weeks ago, Joy passed away. And in a short while, Sherry is going to be with Joy again. Sherry is the kind of person that does not have faith in God only. She has faith in the power of God. And I want to be a little more like her. There is a God. He is alive. In Him we live. In Him we survive. We're going to sing that song. We've pulled an audible. It's not on the screen. It's number 23 in your songbooks, but most of you know it by heart. If you need to respond, you're welcome to come. Let's stand and sing.